History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and, more importantly, invest enough time to listen as memories that may not have seen the light of day in decades start to rise to the surface again. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but more often than not, we end up drawing inspiration from these stories from men and women who've put their lives on the line for the rest of us. If you're a regular listener, you might remember an episode earlier this fall in which we met a Navy Cross recipient named Harry Zinser, whose decoration might have been the Medal of Honor if not for the timing of his heroics in a helicopter behind enemy lines in Vietnam 50 years ago. When that episode aired, I mentioned that eventually we hoped to bring you the story of the jet pilot Harry was so instrumental in rescuing that night, and I'm so thrilled that we get to do that today. 77-year-old Jim Lloyd lives in the Albuquerque, New Mexico area now, but his early years were in the Golden State.
I grew up in the Walnut Creek, Pleasant Hill area. The reason I say there was two, they changes without moving one city to the other, but so I grew up in the East Bay area. I was born in Alameda. I tell everybody it was an island in the Pacific during World War II, but just barely in the war by 6 days and barely an island, but it sounds romantic. And growing up, my parents were really good to us, and my brother is a twin brother, identical brother, and we had come from a long line of identical twins. And my sister, even though she's second fiddle most of the time, was really a sweetheart even to this day. We had a good childhood. I went to college in Humboldt State in 1967. I graduated.
Hold on a second. So you said something there. You said you're from a long line of identical twins. How far back does that go? Give me the depth of that.
Well, my mother's came from six kids, and two of them were identical twins, boys, men. And then my mother had identical twins, and then my identical twin brother had identical twins, and my sister has identical twin granddaughters.
I'm just taking a leap here. You talked about Alameda. Was your father in the Navy or something?
My dad was in the Army. He was a sergeant in the Army and on the Japanese theater, but more, he spent most of his time up in the Aleutians. Then they didn't have a lot of action up there, but he spent quite a few time up there. My mom went up there to meet him, so we basically started our existence up in Canada somewhere when they met for a week of R&R during the war.
So it was World War II that brought your parents together?
They were married beforehand, barely, you know, I think about 1940-41. But my dad went in after Pearl Harbor. I had four uncles that went in, and two of them served in World War I.
And, you know, on this program, our listeners usually hear from World War II veterans. And so I think it's interesting to get your perspective, because what we hear from these World War II vets is, you know, I didn't talk about it for 50, 60, 70 years. Did your father talk to you guys about his World War II service when you were growing up?
Not enough, because as I got older, I really have a lot of questions for him, particularly after he passed on. But he would get together with some of his friends and neighbors, and they were all veterans but one. We would just sit there in awe just listening to them. We played Army a lot, you know, I mean, that was a big thing. We were inspired to them that we wanted to serve our country, but in our own way. We wanted to do it after college and go in and be commissioned and so forth, but they were a big inspiration to us.
You and your twin brother, did you get along pretty well? Were you rivals? How similar are the two of you?
Very similar. If he was coming to this room, he could sit down and start talking, and he'd just pick up where I left off, and you would know who you're talking to. Yeah, we were competitive, but in a good way. I wanted to finish first place in a race, but I wanted him 1 inch behind me, and he felt the same way. So that really kind of drove us, and it was a nice competition. We do that still today. I wanted to go in the military, but I didn't want to make a career out of it. I wanted to stay with my original dreams, but on that note, it was a pretty exciting 5.5 years for me, and I wouldn't trade a minute of it for anything.
But your brother was in the Army before you were in the Navy, is that right?
by 24 hours. He went in on January 8, 1968, and I went in on January 9, 1968. So we were a day apart, and then we followed each other and encouraged each other through training.
But this wasn't your plan. You mentioned you were at Humboldt State, and you were hoping to be able to finish there before having to serve in the military. What happened?
Well, I was to graduate in June of 1967 and December of 66. We'd been student deferments, had good grades, full loads. We had the 2S deferment. And I figured in June we have to go and serve our country, but we wanted to do it as graduates. Well, in December, they changed me to 1A, which is prime B for draft. And they sent me down for my physical and then came back and said, I'll be drafted within a few weeks. And I thought, gosh, I'll never finish. It'll be a couple of years of picking up the pieces when I get out. The week later, the Navy came to the university looking for pilots. I had never been in an airplane in my life, not even an airliner. I took the written test. It was 3.5 hours long. They said, well, you're not obligated, but we'll send you down to Alameda if you want. And they treated me like royalty. They flew me down. I spent the weekend down there and officers club, meeting pilots and whatever, and had my orals. And then they said that you passed everything, but we're going to have to see when you're accepted and when you go in. And so, but you got to go back to school and finish because you have to be commissioned officers to be a pilot. You have to have a degree. And so we'll get the Army off your back. So that's what happened. That's the first time the Navy saved me.
And this is where you and your brother had your paths separate?
Yeah, he somehow, and I can't recall, but he did, because he took his Army physical with me. I think he made some kind of a deal with the Army that he would go in the Army and be commissioned. And so they allowed him to finish. And we both went in, like I say, early part of 68.
And I'll have you share a little bit of what happened to him. But as for you, I mean, you said that you'd never been in an airplane before. And I've had a lot of pilots talk about an initial experience that kind of got them hooked or that they felt that spark for the first time. Did you have a moment like that where you fell in love with the idea of aviation?
Well, the time I got back in January of 67 from the physicals and so forth, it started really riding on me that, you know, I could maybe be a pilot. And I really got excited. By the time I was sworn in June, I really, really, really was smitten with the idea. I really wanted to do it. And, you know, we'd play with our little airplanes and stuff as kids, and that's the closest I've been to it. But I always was thought of neat to fly. And I couldn't have been more right, so, because I really loved it.
And I guess let's take a little detour here and maybe get a nutshell sketch of what your brother went through, because he went over to Vietnam before you and was actually wounded before you were flying over there?
He was. He went over as a second lieutenant. And first of all, he finished training, became an officer in the Green Berets. But he went over the second lieutenant, and he was over there for, it was quite a while for combat, but he wanted to finish the year. But beforehand, they were ambushed, and he was shot and hauled, you know, and he was seriously injured. But he made it back, and after he was healed up and so forth, he continued for another year and a half, finishing up his tour in the Army, and then he got out 2 years before I got out of the Navy.
And I'm just curious what effect that had on you, because you talked about how close you were, how competitive you were with each other and everything. Did it give you pause? Was it sobering to know how close he had come to losing his life there?
Most definitely. The reality of being mortal and really settled in. And I guess from the other standpoint is there was a little bit of vengeance. I wanted to go back, have an opportunity to pick up where he left off and go after them for what they did to him. And that's just my own personal feeling because of being a brother. So.
And I don't want to get ahead of the story here, but you have a little picture on the wall right over here of the two of you standing in front of your twin Purple Heart license plates. And it says, Brothers, Shot Up and Shot Down. What do you think of when you look at that photo?
I think how lucky we are. I think of what we must have put our parents through. But we're real fortunate. You know, he lives up in Twin Falls, of all places, in Idaho. And we try to get together as much as we can. But we have all that. We're blessed that we're able to do that and still be physically capable of enjoying hunting and fishing and doing things like that together, even at our age.
So let's get back to your story. So you're in the Navy now. You are getting to fly. I imagine you flew a few different aircraft before the A-7. What are some of the cockpits you got some time in?
Well, of course, with the trainers, it was a T-34 prop plane that we all flew in. We got finished with that. I flew the T-2A in basic jet training in Meridian, Mississippi for 6 months, and then went to carrier quals on the Lexington, and there they are gunnering the T2B, which is the same thing with twin engine, but they were together, so we call them centerline thrust. And then I went to advanced training flying the F9 Cougar, both the single seat and the tandem seat, for another 6 months, and they got my wings. And then I flew the A4 for a while, the A4 Charlie, which was a wonderful little airplane. And then I transitioned over to the A7s, and I flew the A7A, the A7B, which are pretty much identical, but little upgrades. And then the A7E, which is the when we got home from Vietnam. We flew the A7A over in Vietnam.
And taking off and landing on a carrier is a little different from most pilots, from land-based pilots. Did that take some getting used to, or some things that that you had to feel your way through to get used to that?
It's more of the training, and I think any Navy pilot will agree with me on this. They train, and we train, and we train on a field that's simulated carrier in the daytime. If you're not doing things right, you won't go any further than that. And then when you go out to the first time you carry a call on a ship, in my case, as I mentioned, was the Lexington, there is a tremendous feeling of pride. And you're becoming, on that first trap, you become a member of the elite that's almost 100, but now it's 100 years old. It's just a feeling of pride. But you have to continue to do it to stay current, because there's so many rooms for error. There's so little room for error, and particularly on a pitching deck at night.
Yeah, that's a lot can go wrong. And you would end up in a situation where even more went wrong, and there was some particular training that I know came in real handy for us. Explain to us what SEER training is and why that was so valuable for you.
SEER is Survival, Escape, Resistant, and Evasion training. It's about a week long, and if you're going into combat, you have to go through it. They give you a bunch of briefing, training, and so forth, and then you're evading, and you have really soldiers chasing you. They have accents. I mean, they're Americans, but after a while, your mind plays tricks on you, and you're actually evading the enemy. And the elements are pretty tough. You haven't eaten much. You eventually, your mind gets to the point where you are in a real POW camp. And then when they figure that you've coordinated yourself enough as a group and started planning and trying to escape and this kind of stuff, they'll terminate it in a really touching way. In my case, it was, they took a guy going through it, gave him an American flag, and he told him to take off running and go put it up the flagpole. And so he did that, yelling that, "I got the flag, I got the flag." A bunch of the guards jumped on him and started beating him. And we went and started beating the heck out of the guards. And then somebody raised the flag up the flagpole. And I remember the guy I was taking my anger out on yells up and says, "Salute your flag." And I looked up, and the American flag's there. The national anthem comes. And then this, in our case, was an A4 Skyhawk. Flies right over the trees at high speed, and there wasn't a dry eye in the place, and it was over with. But it convinced me, as many of us, I don't want to ever be captured. I couldn't imagine going through, instead of a day and a half, 8 years that some of these guys did.
And I'm just curious, while you were going through that training, which is supposed to simulate what this is really going to be like if you end up in one of these situations, how did you feel about it? It doesn't sound very comfortable or something that you would actually embrace, but more that at least I would dread. How did you feel about it while you were going through it?
The training?
Yeah.
I'm afraid. You don't know where it's going. You don't want to screw up. You know, you want to be there for your buddies, but it's easy to, we all made mistakes, and they grade you on it, and then you're debriefed about it. But it's something you did not look forward to. And you were glad it's behind you. And those that failed it, either physically had problems or didn't do the right thing and had to go back, I'm sure it was an awful nightmare. But it's geared to be a very trying, demanding, I'd say even terrible experience, but that's better there than the real thing.
Yeah, and I'm just going to ask you a real dumb, simple, straightforward question. Do you think we'd be sitting here talking to each other if you hadn't had that training?
That's a good question. I probably would have felt similarly because of, you know, my brother and I always played around with survival, and Explorer Scouts was based on survival and stuff. We really enjoyed that kind of Sneaky Pete stuff. That's why he went in the Green Berets. What SEER really helped me was, one, it could really set it deep that I was right. I don't want to get caught. But the other thing is, I there was things that I didn't know about that they taught us. And, you know, that the North Vietnamese would do things that would really, really freak me out. And I knew that, expected it. And so from SEER would taught us that. Yeah, it scared me, but it didn't surprise me. It didn't derail my thinking that, on that one night.
Eventually, we'll hear quite a bit about that night, that fateful night, that unforgettable night, what Jim Lloyd does not hesitate to call a miraculous night 50 years ago. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, what this decorated fighter pilot's carrier-based missions were like in Vietnam. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of Jim then and now. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.